You're listening to the Diplomat's Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C.
And this is Ankit Panda, also in Washington, D.C. Good to be with you again, Katie.
Good to see you, Ankit, after so long. We are stoked today to welcome a special guest, Jim Sciutto. Jim is currently CNN's chief national security correspondent, but he has a long history covering Asia and I think can offer us some insights on the evolution of U.S.-Asia policy. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jim.
Great to be here. You know, you guys are right up my alley. Looking forward.
we're stoked to have you. I think especially given it's mid-November now, but an obvious place to start is U.S. President Donald Trump's late October trip to Asia. It took him through Malaysia, Japan, South Korea. And Jim, as you were watching that trip, I'm curious, you know, what were some of the highlights and what do you think they say to us about U.S.-Asia policy at this juncture?
Let's see. A few thoughts. For one, I would say big picture, it was a stabilizing trip, right? That our Asian partners and diplomats in the region who, you know, in my experience, they like crave calm, you know, even my time in Beijing. They just want folks to get along, right? They don't want big disruptions. No wars. Let's keep doing business. And I think that big picture to see, in particular, Trump and Xi meet and you know, basically sign a trade truce, that it was a calming trip. In terms of U.S. objectives, you know, on the trade war, I think it demonstrated that the Trump administration hasn't got a lot out of it with China, right? I mean, if you look at their stated big-term objectives, one of which was always largely pie in the sky, right? Drawing manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. from China quickly. Or even in great numbers, but also, you know, crushing in effect Chinese trade misbehavior from the American perspective, you know, through the years, dumping, you know, stealing intellectual property, et cetera, all of which is true and all of which has been happening for many years. But it's not clear that that has changed measurably, right, in the last several months. And one thing that is clear, right, is that China very much demonstrated its leverage, right, particularly on rare earths. At the end of the day, you know, the president got a one-year reprieve on rare earths because it became clear very quickly that that is China's kind of, you know, knife in the back, right, for the U.S. economy, for the president. You know, and by the way, China stood to lose a lot from a protracted trade war and is suffering economically at home. But with rare earths, it was able to say, hey, if you go too far, you know, I'm gonna keep this hanging over your head. In addition to that, of course, buying U.S. agricultural products, you know, that yes, those have started again, but that was the status quo ante, right? So basically the win was returning, you know, at least Chinese agricultural purchases for now back to where they were. So not a lot gained of this, except that the two nations came back to some degree from the precipice. The final thing I'll say, and I think this is important, that the U.S. and China agreeing to restart military communications is a big deal, because everybody I talk to, and I'm sure you have the same experience for years, has said, you know, their concern is about the small interaction that becomes something bigger. And those hotlines, as it were, between military commanders matter to help diffuse those potential interactions or hot spots, danger points.
Yeah, so Jim, you know, I think we'll get to the allies in a second, because I do want to talk a bit about what happened in Korea and Japan. But while we're on the U.S.-China topic, it'd be helpful for you to share your sense of how the other countries in Asia, I mean, primarily non-aligned states, maybe some of the more neutral countries, are viewing this moment in U.S.-China relations, right? I think it was the former prime minister of Singapore, Lee Hsien Loong, that kind of put it poetically when he said, you know, when elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. I'm paraphrasing. And these days, you know, I think use the term stability. I agree with you. I think Asian countries generally want predictability. They want economic predictability, diplomatic predictability. And that's not a lot of what they've been getting out of Washington over the last 10 months. Yep. So what's your sense of where we are after this trip in terms of how countries are reading this moment in U.S.-China relations? Do you think there's some of the risks are better priced in now from where they were earlier this year, or do you think that there are sort of anxieties that are still lingering about how this could all fall apart maybe next year?
I would say, you know, it's a truce, not a peace, right? And that's the view out there too, that you get pulled back from the precipice, you set aside some of the most incendiary issues between Beijing and Washington, but not forever. And that uncertainty that you talk about, Ankit, which is something that I hear every business leader I speak to, big business and small business, and diplomat from, you know, in Asia, but certainly in Europe as well and elsewhere, like, we need predictability, and they don't have it. You know, businesses can't make plans 3, 6, 9, you know, months out when the tariffs could change based on, if you look at U.S. Canada, right, you know, based on a television ad that Trump doesn't like, you know, these things have consequences. So my sense is, and I spoke to a lot of folks out in the region in the wake of the visit, is that it's nice to have some clarity for now, but no one's betting a ranch on that going forward because, you know, it could be upended.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I want to turn us to the alliances. You know, before Trump's visit to Asia, before he reached Japan, we had another guest on the podcast, Yuki Tatsumi, as a longtime writer for The Diplomat. And she, you know, I asked her a lot about Japanese politics and the current situation. But I asked her, you know, what she would be watching when Donald Trump was in Japan. And said she would be closely watching sort of the interaction between Donald Trump and the new prime minister, Takeuchi, who was, you know, an acolyte of Abe's, Abe, somebody that Donald Trump really, really liked. And I think she was right. There was certainly a lot of positive images that came out of that Japan visit. My question to you is, you know, how much does that matter? You know, how have you seen Trump's sort of personal sentiments and whether he likes somebody or not sway or factor into policymaking? Because I think it's something we usually don't consider, you know, how much do the leaders like each other? But it seems to matter a little bit more with Donald Trump. So I'm curious about your reflections on that, as well as the U.S.-Japan relationship in this new era in both countries.
I think, you know, in scientific terms, a whole heck of a lot. Right? We see examples of that every day. I mean, take the Latin America example, right? He likes the leader of Argentina, and in the midst of a government shutdown is willing to write a check for $20 to $40 billion to bail the economy out. He is angered by Brazil prosecuting his old friend Jair Bolsonaro for attempting to overturn the election and slaps 50% sanctions, right? Mm-hmm. With actually not just consequences for the Brazilian economy, but for us too. You know, our coffee's more expensive, right? I mean, there's an immediate impact from this. Boy, and that's down to those two personal relationships. Does it make sense in terms of U.S. Latin American policy? Is there some consistent principle that you can draw from that, those two diametrically opposed approaches? No. So it's it really matters in so many instances. And when you look to Asia, I think many in Japan are encouraged by the strength of that relationship and what appeared to be genuine warmth in the room between the Japanese and U.S. leaders on that trip. Because in Japan, and I hear similar concerns in South Korea, and by the way, I just got back from Europe, I hear similar concerns in Europe, is that not too far below the surface are genuine questions and doubts as to how committed the U.S. is to those defense partnerships, to what degree. You know, Trump has proven at the start of the administration, you know, the concern, the most extreme concern was that Trump would walk right out of defense alliances. I mean, you had folks who thought, folks who worked for him in his first administration, right, who thought he might walk away from NATO, you know, that kind of thing. He hasn't done it. But the question is degree, right? And when push comes to shove, is the U.S. there for these allies if they were to be attacked? Would this commander-in-chief send U.S. forces to defend Japan or South Korea or Taiwan, right? That's why, I didn't bring that up about the Xi-Trump meeting, but the fact that the U.S. president did not mention the fate of Taiwan was notable and did not comfort the people, you know, Taiwanese officials, because they didn't hear that. So I think it's, my sense is that, and I heard this, I was just in Europe and I was speaking to some of our NATO partners there. They won't say it in public, but in private, they express genuine concerns as to how committed the U.S. is to their defense. And you see them making national security decisions to take on a greater role for their own defense as a result.
Yeah. I mean, the analogy that I often use to describe these sort of summit moments that Trump has with both allies and adversaries, right, is that of kind of shaking a magic eight ball. We have an international listenership, so I'm not sure if that translates. But, you know, there's basically a children's toy that you shake and you'll get a different answer every time. And I think this time the allies shook the magic eight ball, at least Japan and Korea, and I think they're pretty happy with the outcome. I think they felt like they managed Trump well. They didn't have like a high profile, you know, Zelensky style blow up or you know, a Munich security conference style kind of embarrassment, so to speak, on their own soil. So all said and done, I think it sort of helps them communicate to their publics that the alliance with the United States is on solid ground. I think, you know, Trump told Takaichi that, you know, Japan would get anything it needs if it's attacked. And, you know, the fact that he said that, I think, goes a long way.
It does. The thing is, though, a magic eight ball is not a great foundation for an existential national security policy. And if you're South Korea and you're thinking, you know, North Korea is an existential threat to us. You know, it is nice to hear those words in the moment and the moves for now, but it's you can't, again, bet your own national survival on it, which is the concern I hear. And it's not, I wouldn't say that concern has reached a level of alarmism, but it's just there under the surface in virtually every conversation I have in private with some of these officials and leaders. And it's understandable, right? Because, you know, it's part of a broader American pullback from some of these relationships and commitments.
Yeah. So, Jim, let me ask you, you know, you spend a lot of time, you're uniquely positioned. You're in D.C., you're a journalist, you talk to everybody from, you know, you talk to people here in Washington, people in foreign governments and the business community. What's the one thing you think people maybe in Asian strategic elite spaces and governments, in maybe some of the militaries out there, you know, allies, neutral countries alike, what are they not getting about Washington right now? I mean, Washington is harder to read than it has been. You can't really use the old playbook that your embassies, for instance, have set up over decades to sort of understand this particular moment. So what are the big things you think people are getting wrong in Asia in terms of understanding what exactly is going on? You know, I mean, I've been trying to explain this government shutdown, for instance, to some of our allies, kind of a difficult thing to do, why the U.S. government has been shut down for 40 plus days now as of this recording. But that's just one example. What are the big ones that sort of strike you?
I will say I get a lot of questions and genuine alarm about some of the images and events that you see on our streets. I mean, you see, you know, the immigration raids, the way that they're conducted at the extremes raise genuine concerns for folks because, you know, I've lived overseas for most of my professional life, and this is not the first time that a U.S. leader has been unpopular abroad or that there have been questions about U.S. foreign policy, God knows, right? I mean, I was in Europe during the Iraq invasion in 2003. You know, I've been to 1,000 dinner parties where I'm, you know, sitting there at the end of the table and just taking fire, right? You know, from – so it's not the first time, right? And you go back to the 70s and the 60s, you know. So, you know, that's happened before, but the degree of some of these changes causes genuine concern. And I would say even alarm or, you know, when they look at, you know, the election process in this country, because, you know, for all that history of criticism, folks have generally had confidence in the functioning of the American system, that, you know, peaceful transfer of power, all that kind of stuff. And you know, the idea that, you know, soft power matters, it does. In my experience and in years of covering the world, that you know, the advertisement and functioning of those values does have power abroad. I'm not saying it, you know, tells Xi Jinping what to do, but, you know, people respond to that. And it's, you know, the impression of that, the view of that is changing because of quite concrete moves, you know, just over the course of the last less than a year. And that has, you know, it's interesting. I a few months ago, I was riding the train back to DC from New Haven, and someone came up to me and said, you know, you really have to get Joe Nye on CNN to talk about the importance of soft power. Joe Nye, of course, the legendary Harvard professor and the man who coined the term soft power years ago. So the next day I got to talk to my show team and we reached out and we got Joe Nye on the air and he described the importance of it and how the loss of that in a number of respects will have impact for U.S. power projection abroad. Sadly, it was one of the last interviews he did because he passed away early. I think he died like a few days afterwards. And I thought, you know, it was almost a, you know, he was using his voice to the last minute, sounding the alarm about the impact of that. And that is something that I hear, and that's in Asia, in Europe. I hear it from folks I speak to in Latin America. It's got real impact.
Mm-hmm.
I want to sort of pull on a thread you kind of hinted at earlier in that answer, you know, on some of the evolution in U.S. foreign policy towards Asia over the decades. You know, do you see sort of Donald Trump's style and Donald Trump in terms of his Asia policy as an aberration, or does it fit into a larger shift that was kind of underway regardless? You know, I'm curious about, you know, your reflections on that evolution of U.S. policy.
Donald Trump recognized and really turned the ship of American foreign policy on China to quite publicly identifying Chinese, you know, misbehavior, right, on trade, I mean, which was preceded his administration by many years, right? You know, mm-hmm. stealing state and private sector secrets and cheating on trade in a whole host of ways. And now that is effectively a bipartisan approach to China in this country. And President Trump deserves credit for that. And it's interesting, when I was in Beijing and working for the government at the time, so this is 2011, 2013, it was a time where everybody knew what China was up to in the trade space, but was really reluctant to say it in public or be too critical. Companies knew, and they would come to the embassy for help and say, hey, don't put my company's name in this because we don't want to get in trouble. You know, we don't want to have our business upset. And then I think, you know, diplomats too and policymakers, I'll give an example because I was thinking about this the other day when China launched its third aircraft carrier. When they launched their first aircraft, you know, because it wasn't just fear, it was also a misreading, I think, of Chinese government ambitions. When they had their first aircraft carrier, this is back around, it was when I was in the embassy, so 2011, 2012, which was actually interesting little historical fact. It was a Ukrainian Navy ship, which mm-hmm. they bought, and then they finished it up to the read in the U.S. Embassy and in the State Department was, this is just an ego piece. It's not, they've got no desires for a blue water Navy. They don't really want to project power beyond, you know, the first island chain, all this kind of stuff. And I was sitting there, I was like, really? I mean, I'm watching pretty big military build. Are we?
It's a big purchase for a joke.
That view proven absolutely wrong. And I think that permeated a lot of U.S. policy. If you look at the way the U.S. basically got snowed on the South China Sea, you know, there then, you know, it's like, they're not really serious about, you know, militarizing these islands and so on. Now we have, you know, China owns the South China Sea and has those unsinkable aircraft carriers there, as the Navy calls to them. So I think, you know, when you look at the Trump policy going back to his first term, he has steered American policy in a direction which there is quite broad agreement on. Now it's all in the implementation. And when you look at the trade war, you know, I think you could say fairly reasonably that, you know, declaring trade war on China certainly hasn't gotten, it may have attracted a lot of attention, hasn't gotten the U.S. what it's wanted in terms of fundamentally changing that relationship yet. Is that a short-term the U.S. blinking or a longer-term the U.S. blinking? We'll only see.
All right. Ankit, do you have any final questions before we let Jim get on with his day?
Well,
I'm just getting started, guys. You know,
we could go on for hours.
China, we can go on for hours.
But our listeners will be mad if we go on too long.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the final question I would just ask, I mean, sort of lingering on, you know, Jim's last answer, is really thinking about the potential here for, you know, crises and conflicts, right? I mean, I think we talked a bit about the importance of U.S.-China military communications coming back in at least a fairly modest way. But Jim, sort of, you know, what keeps you up at night in terms of the thing that could really go wrong in Asia, right? We have a bunch of flashpoints that implicate the United States directly, some that implicate the United States indirectly. What are the ones that sort of keep you up?
I worry about, you know, a ship to ship or jet-to-jet conflict. They're getting close to each other all the time.
Unsafe and intercepts, collisions.
Yeah. Intercepts, collisions, you know, and this is deliberate, right? You'll see Chinese vessels and sometimes with Russian vessels or aircraft nearby, they often work hand in hand. You know, you had a couple where they steer right in front of a U.S. destroyer going through, say, the South China Sea. You see that with some of the air interactions as well. I was in a U.S. spy plane over the South China Sea in 2015 when we were, they didn't accost us in the air, but they definitely shouted to us from the ground, you know, from armed positions saying, get out of the way. At some point, you worry about someone shooting at someone or maybe wings clipping and someone going down and you have a, you have an opportunity for escalation. And that's in my most recent book, The Return of Great Powers, I interviewed Bill Burns, of course, then CIA director, and I asked him what kept him up at night. And he said exactly that. He's like, a small interaction, either with China or Russia, that escalates into something bigger. And I worry about that as we see, for instance, increased activity, Chinese military activity around Taiwan, because, you know, not just for our own security interests or concerns about escalation, but also for, you know, the future of Taiwan. I've been spent a lot of time there, and you know, this is a place that wants to be on its own. It certainly doesn't want to be absorbed into the PRC. What happens if China senses this might be the right time? The U.S. is distracted. You know, Trump's not really into it. You know, do you find yourself in something bigger? That keeps me up at night, and that's why, you know, when I saw that they're resuming military to military communications, that's good. Certainly doesn't solve the big picture issues, but at least provides an opportunity to walk some of those, dial some of those situations down.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jim and Ankit. This was a great conversation. We look forward to having you back sometime again. And thanks to everyone for listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics podcast. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you don't miss out on future episodes. You can now also watch these on YouTube if that is your thing. And as always, you can get in touch with Ankit or myself with episode suggestions, guest suggestions. We'll be back soon with more. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys. Thanks so much for having me.